that consideration was not lost on the king, he said. Set up a base in Tilt, too, while he's at it, Nate suggested. Gregory Tilton is a sure bet to change sides a half dozen times before this war is over, but he might be more wary if there were guards in his backyard. Chelly leaned forward. She was a plain-featured, strong-willed, absolutely imperturbable woman whom Seneth had come to greatly admire during the few times they had been together. But Seneth was impressed with the imprints of grace and ease that Chelly had left on Brassenthwaite. She was impressed with the well-behaved children. She was impressed by the fact that Kiernan actually seemed to listen to her. "Let's talk about something other than war," she said now.
"It's all anyone is thinking about," Kiernan said.
She said gently, "Because that's all anyone is talking about. Let's discuss something else, at least for a few minutes, just to prove to our guests that we can." She turned smoothly to Cammon. "I understand you've been traveling with my sister-in-law. Tell me a little bit about your own family." Cammon never minded being the focus of attention, and was never intimidated by anyone else's rank and title. He shook back his shaggy hair and smiled at her. "My parents were wanderers," he said. "I spent a lot of time in Arborhast and Sovenfeld. Have you ever been to either of them?" No one at the table had.
"I hear they've got good soldiers in Arborhast," Kiernan said.
"Kiernan," Chelly reprimanded. "I don't know if they're any good, but there are a lot of them," Cammon said. "But I never had any dealings with them. Mostly my mother and I worked in the honey spice fields while my father did business deals." "Honey spice? It grows in Arborhast?" Chelly asked. Cammon nodded. "Great fields of it. In the spring, every plant has about 10 bright red blossoms, and the fields just stretch on forever. You can stand in the middle of a honey spice field, and everywhere you look, all you see is red."
Between Chelly's promptings and Cammon's willingness to talk, much of the rest of the meal passed in a travelogue of sorts. Seneth was fairly certain that her brothers were bored with the conversation, but the children were fascinated, and even Sabina seemed to like the tales. But it wouldn't have been a meal with Cammon if he hadn't then started asking questions of his own, guilelessly and with complete sincerity, wanting to know where Chelly was from, what the children were learning, who was the oldest, where they had traveled. Soon enough, Cammon, Chelly, and the heirs to Brassenthwaite were chatting happily among themselves, while her brothers and Tays began a sotto voce discussion of war strategy again. Worse ways to spend an evening, Seneth supposed. She was not particularly interested in either conversation, so she played with her food and thought over the prospect of a trip to Den Illustris. Well, it would be good to see Kira again, if indeed the flighty Saramara could be found there. She was even more restless than Seneth, and could hardly be counted on to spend two nights in the same location. But Malcolm Den Illustris would make Seneth welcome, and so would Kasara in her cool way. Will and Kasara. It might work. Among the Saramar and Saramara, sometimes the best you could hope for was that an arranged marriage would not be disastrous, as a wedding between Halkan Giseltas and Seneth would have been. Seneth didn't even want to think about what Sabina's life had been like these past 15 years. Although Sabina was no mystic, she would not feel, as Seneth did, her sense of magic drain away the moment Halkan put his hand anywhere on her body. Sabina might hate him for his cruelty, for his coldness, for his driven ambition, but any wife might hate a husband for those reasons. Seneth had had other reasons to fear and despise the man who had been heir to Giseltas. Kiernan pushed his chair away from the table. He was done with the meal.
"So," he said, "we have no entertainments planned since we weren't expecting your arrival. You can make yourselves free of the house, of course. But if you have no further need of me, I'm going to retire to my study and go over accounts."
Tays rose deliberately to his feet, and everyone reflexively turned to look at him. He appeared relaxed, but Seneff noted the placement of his hands, lightly resting on his belt, inches from his sword and dagger, and the way he was balanced on his feet. ready for combat, if combat came. She stared at him, completely nonplussed, then glanced at Kamen, who was looking down at his plate to hide his expression and trying hard not to laugh. What, by the bright mother's golden hand, was Taze planning to say?
"Marlord Kiernan," Taze began formally. "A minute of your time, please."
Kiernan, never caught off guard, merely nodded.
"We can withdraw to my study if you like."
Taze glanced around the room. He met Seneth's eyes fleetingly and returned his attention to his host.
"I would like to speak before the entire family, if I may."
"Certainly."
"I'm 40 years old. I have spent the last 22 years as a king's rider, like my father and his father before me. The king would trust me with his life, and every man who knows me would tell you I am honorable. There is not a chapter in my life that I would be embarrassed to have you read. But I do not come from noble stock."
Seneth was motionless in her chair. Her body was alternately weighted like stone and blazing with fire. She could not lift her hand to hide her face. She could not have spoken, no matter what the incentive. Around her, she could hear the others shifting in their seats, could catch the quick looks that passed between Will and Nate, between Kiernan and Chelly, but she could not move. She could not look away from Taze's dark, stern face.
"I realize that it would benefit you to arrange a marriage between your sister and a son of the 12 houses, Taze went on. "I believe you tried such a match some years ago, and it did not succeed, and that you might be hoping to persuade her to consider another marriage now. I understand that any lesser match degrades her in the eyes of your world. I understand that I am not good enough to marry her."
Now Seneth was able to move one hand, and she used it to cover her mouth. In a minute she would be using it to wipe her eyes. She still could not speak.
"And yet, I love her, and she loves me," Taze continued. "And I will marry her, if she will agree. But you are her brothers, you are her family, you are all of a noble house. Before I ask her, I would want to know that you look upon my suit with favor. I know you will not believe I deserve her, but perhaps you will agree to let me have her, even so."
He stopped, and there was absolute silence in the room. From the corner of her eye, Seneth could see Nate's black frown, Will's delighted smile, and Shelley's look of surprise and pleasure. Not often anyone got to witness such a declaration. Almost any woman would let it melt her heart. Kiernan, as befitted the Marlord of the most powerful house in Gilengaria, carefully thought over the proposition before he replied. He did not look either surprised or offended. Kiernan never bothered with pointless emotions. He was actually, Seneth thought with some indignation, considering the advantages and disadvantages.
"When the king dies, what happens to you as one of his riders?" Kiernan asked.
Inquiring into job prospects, Seneth thought, repressing the urge to laugh hysterically. "As if I needed someone to feed me and take care of my household expenses." Taze nodded, as if this was a fair question.
"Princess Amelie, upon becoming queen, dismisses all the riders, that is tradition, and those she chooses to re-engage, she then hires back. Thus, they make their oaths of fealty directly to her. I have no way of predicting if I would be among the riders she would choose to keep. My hope is that I would. And if you are not, I have some skill with a sword. I would be able to sell my services elsewhere. Besides the king and your fellow riders, who would vouch for your character and your ability as a fighter? I believe the regent, Romar Brendan, would speak of me highly." Taze inclined his head slightly. "And you yourself have had a first-hand opportunity to judge me. I have stayed in your house and eaten at your table. You must have formed an opinion." Indeed. I have been most impressed by your intelligence, your steadfastness, and your loyalty, Kiernan said. Then will you allow me to wed your sister?
Sarah Mara, do not marry King's Riders, Nate burst out, unable to contain himself any longer. Not even the best of the Riders, as we all know you to be.
Kiernan gave Nate a quelling look. But we have long ago given up any notion of marrying Seneth off for political gain, Kiernan said.
Well, we never thought she'd be willing to marry anyone, Will interposed. He was laughing.
He received a quelling look, too. And we have long recognized that whatever our plans for Seneth, she would do whatever she desired, so our opinions have never mattered much to her.
Your opinions matter to me, Taze said.
Kiernan nodded. You are the king's man, and Brassenthwaite serves the king. It would be an honor to welcome you into our family as my sister's husband. He stood up, his wine goblet in his hand, and saluted the rider.
You have the blessing of the house.
So there was, after all, entertainment for the evening, despite the fact that the host and hostess had not thought to provide music or dancing. Everyone ignored Nate's black looks and joined in a celebration. Chelly called for more wine, and even let the children raise a toast to Aunt Seneth and her unconventional suitor. Will came around the table and lifted Seneth off her feet in a rib-cracking hug, while Cammon ran up to Taze and pounded him on the back. Kiernan stepped up to shake Taze's hand, but no one else had the nerve to get too close to the rider, even when he was clearly in a benevolent mood. Seneth herself did not want to come near enough to touch him. She was afraid she would combust. Sabina made her way around the table and took Seneth's hands in her small, cold ones. She was smiling wistfully.
I feel like I should be very shocked, she said. A Sarah Mara and a King's Rider? And I am, a little bit, and yet I think, is this a chance at happiness? I did not have such a chance myself. I would very much like someone else to be able to. If you love him, Seneth, marry him.
I love him, Seneth said in a choked voice. Sabina pushed herself to her tiptoes and kissed Seneth on the cheek.
Oh, then I am so happy for you, and I envy you from the bottom of my heart.
Chelly pulled Seneth aside next. Shall you be married from Brassenthwaite? Kiernan would like that, I think. We could invite all the 12 houses. Seneth could imagine few things more horrible.
Oh, Chelly, I don't think so. A quiet ceremony, probably in Gosen Hall. I haven't... Trust me, this is something of a shock to me. I haven't thought it through. But I would not be planning on some event at Brassen Court.
Well, if you change your mind, let me know. I would be happy to help you plan.
Cammon came up behind her and put his arms around her waist.
You should have seen your expression, he said. You would have thought Taze was asking permission to cut off your head.
She turned to face him, and he dropped his arms. He was grinning widely.
You could have warned me he was planning this.
I didn't realize it till he stood up. Anyway, I wouldn't have told. It was more fun this way. He laughed. I've never seen Taze nervous before. I didn't know he could get nervous. Justin won't believe it.
Someday I hope to see you endure great public humiliation, she said, her tone heartfelt.
He laughed again. Probably won't happen. I almost never get embarrassed. I mean, I don't even know when I'm supposed to be embarrassed.
Well, then, I hope you fall in love with the wrong person and everybody stares and whispers about you.
Now that might happen someday. Seems like the sort of thing I'd do.
At last, everyone had had enough opportunities to exclaim and congratulate and offer good wishes. It was almost winter. The sun had long since gone down. Sabina yawned and said she was exhausted, and the others all expressed the intention of seeking their beds. Seneth did not look at Taze as she kissed the children goodnight and promised to talk more with Chelly in the morning. By the time she was heading toward the stairs, Taze had collected Kamen and the two of them climbed up behind her, Kamen talking with great animation. Taze, like Seneth, was mostly silent. She stepped inside their bedroom first, while he paused a moment in the hall to exchange a final word with Kamen. The cool air warmed merely from her presence. She bent at the grate to kindle a fire with her fingertips. Pacing across the room, she lit candles on the armoire, before the window, beside the bed. Taze stepped inside and set the lock, then stood unmoving before the door. She was halfway across the room, and both of them were in partial shadow. He was the first to speak.
"It hardly does me any good to abase myself before the Marlord if the woman I love will refuse to have me."
"Oh, that's a risk, it is," she said in a soft voice, staying where she was. "Saramara are notoriously fickle. They toy with men's affections because they only play at love."
"Although they play very well," he said judiciously.
She was surprised into a laugh. She reached up and began slowly unbuttoning the front of her dress. She had changed from her travel trousers into more ladylike attire for the meal, so at least she looked properly soft and womanly for this momentous occasion. Still, the dress must have 25 buttons. What had she been thinking? She undid the ones down to her waist and then shrugged out of the sleeves.
"I am not entirely clear," she said. "On the king's policy toward his riders, I know some of them are married, but very few. Is there any prohibition in place?"
She pushed the dress down to her ankles and stepped out of it, leaving her shoes behind as she did so. Now she was wearing a chemise and an underslip borrowed from Chelly. She took a few steps closer to Taze and began pulling at the lace holding the chemise together. He stayed where he was, but she could see him smiling in the candlelight.
"The formal policy is that riders are not encouraged to marry," he said. "Thus, the tradition is that all riders elope, theoretically to avoid risking the ire of their king by asking permission to wed. In reality, Baron has always been quite delighted when his riders have found themselves husbands and wives. He has always been most extravagant with wedding gifts."
There, the chemise was off. The underslip was balled up and thrown in a corner. Seneth was standing there entirely nude, except for two pieces of jewelry, the glowing moonstone bracelet around her left wrist and the golden pendant around her throat. Both of them seemed hot against her skin this night. Both of them were pulling fire from her own wakened magic. Four more steps, and she was inches away from him. He had not moved or attempted to disrobe. He had not so much as lifted the embroidered sash of lions over his head. She placed her hands on his shoulders and let him feel the heat in her palms all the way through the layers of his clothing to his taut flesh beneath.
"Yes, Taze, I will marry you," she whispered, and lifted her mouth to kiss him. "If you will have me, I will be entirely yours."
That was all he had wanted to hear, apparently. He swept her up and carried her to the bed, kissing her so hard she gave up on any hope of breathing. The candles guttered and flickered, the fire hissed and leaped up, but they lay on the bed together, a conflagration of their own between them, and did not look away from each other for the whole of that long night. Chapter 24. The last 2 weeks had crawled by at a glacial pace, and even the gathering dark of oncoming winter could not cheer Eleanor up. She felt confused and restless and uneasy and lonely and, just the tiniest bit, at risk. Justin had called her a mystic.
She was sure it wasn't true, and yet it could be true. He knew more about such things than she did. Eleanor had explained to him very earnestly that the goddess had conferred small magics upon her, and he had replied impatiently, "Yes, of course, magic is a gift from the gods," which no one in the convent had ever said or seemed to believe, so perhaps he was wrong. It was not like she could ask. It was not like Darris or Chevelle would sit down with her and kindly delineate what constituted sorcery and what did not. "Oh, your ability to heal with the touch? That's not magic. We don't mind such displays. The Lestra would not be at all disturbed to learn you had such powers." The Lestra would be unhappy indeed. Eleanor began to think Justin was right. She needed to leave the convent. She began formulating letters in her head, during the days while she was cooking in the kitchen, during the nights when she could not sleep. "My dear father, I miss the family. I miss the feast days. Please, may I come home for a visit? Rosierie does not want to leave, but please, may I come home?" That might not be strong enough. Neither her father nor her uncle would want her to leave Rosierie behind, and a little homesickness would not seem to them to merit the long trip across the mountains to fetch her. Maybe she should write Torin instead. If he believed she was unhappy, he would sail across the world to find her. He would battle the guards at the convent gates. He would bundle her up across his horse and go pounding back out into the forest, racing away till they were free of pursuit. "My brother, come for me. They are cruel to me here." That would fetch him for certain. He wouldn't even balk at leaving Rosierie behind, or, more likely, would drag her along with them, screaming and protesting that she didn't want to leave. Still, Eleanor didn't believe she could actually write such a note. She had no proof that the Lestra, or Chevelle, or Darris, read their outgoing mail, but she had often suspected they did. Certainly letters that arrived for them had been opened. "The Pale Lady sees all. There are no secrets from her," Chevelle had told them all when Astira complained about this practice. Well, the Black Mother kept plenty of secrets. That was what she did best. There was a letter Eleanor could send that was guaranteed to bring both her father and her brother dashing across the border. "My family, I have fallen in love with a man of Gilengaria." That would drive them across the Lyrith Mountains in record time. But that was the very last letter she would write. If she decided to leave the convent, she would have to do so on her own, in secrecy. But she would have to have a plan in place, somewhere to go, somewhere to take refuge if the guards came after her, as she thought they might. Neft would be the first place they looked. Could she make it all the way to Korriban on her own? Would Marlord Heffel take her in? Would he help her get safely back to the Sabbata? She was not worried about escaping the compound itself. She knew it could be done. Just a few days ago, hadn't she aided in the escape of that poor, sad creature, Marlord Halcon's wife? There had been such an uproar when it was discovered she was missing, and Eleanor had felt a peculiar satisfaction in knowing she had been the one to send the whole convent into a frenzy, not quite so helpless as she sometimes felt. She hadn't thought it through, though, before she did it. It had been a cold, sunny afternoon, and the novices were spending the day in the forest, gathering. That was what they always called it, when they streamed out in large, untidy groups and went ranging through the forest for whatever they could find. Most of the younger girls just brought back armloads of wood for the fires. The country girls, the farmers' daughters, hunted for mushrooms and nuts, knowing what was edible and what was not. The more frivolous ones brought back bouquets of wildflowers, useless but beautiful. And this went on all day. They poured through the open convent gates, fanned out through the woods, and returned, laughing and flushed with the exercise. Eleanor loved the gathering days. Most of them did. They offered welcome breaks from the precise routines of everyday life. On her second or third trip through the gates, in company with Rosary and Astira and a half-dozen of her other friends, Eleanor had noticed the Marlord's wife standing to one side, watching them. She had been here for quite some time, this visit, she and her husband and a whole troop of men. The Gieseltest soldiers, of course, stayed mostly in the barracks, and the novices only got a glimpse or two of the Lestra's fearsome brother. But the small, pale woman had drifted around the compound, clearly at loose ends, looking fragile and lost. On this particular afternoon, she stood near the gates as the novices flitted to and fro, a wistful expression on her face, as if she did not think she would be allowed to set foot outside, as if she had forgotten what freedom felt like. On her third trip back in through the gates, her baskets heavy with nuts, Eleanor had casually brushed past the Marlady. "We're going to make one last trip out into the forest," she said, her voice so low almost no one would have been able to hear it. "Would you like to come with us?" The blonde woman had looked both pleased and frightened. "Oh, I would, but I shouldn't." She glanced over her shoulder, where two men in black and red livery stood talking with some of the convent soldiers, there to guard the Marlady, no doubt.
"Come with us, as we drop all this inside," Eleanor said. "No one is paying attention. Then just come back out with us as we leave again in a few minutes. It will do you good to get some air and exercise." "Oh," the Marlady said again, still indecisive, but she followed Eleanor and Astira to the kitchen at the back of the convent.
And she followed them to the front of the compound again, and stood quietly listening, while Astira and Leah giggled over something Semi had said. Not sure such a trick would work in the daylight, Eleanor invoked a little of the Black Mother's power. Oh, very well, call it magic, to make the Marlady virtually disappear. When Rosary and two other girls finally joined them at the gate, Astira said, "Let's go," and they all stepped outside. The Marlady was in their midst, and no one noticed her. Not the convent guards, not the Gieseltest soldiers, not even the other novices, beside whom she paced in utter silence. Clearly, this magic was even more powerful than Eleanor had realized, if it could cloak a grown woman who stood in the direct sun. They spread out as they pushed deeper into the woods, the younger girls looking for kindling, Astira and Eleanor more focused on seeds and nuts. The Marlady slowed down, fell behind, backed away. Eleanor tried not to watch her. When, 20 minutes later, Eleanor looked around, the Marlady was nowhere in sight. No one knew when she had gone or where. Soldiers were sent out that very afternoon, and the next day, and the next, but they never came back with the errant wife. Astira whispered that Leah had overheard a great shouting match between the Lestra and her brother. She had not been able to catch the words, but that he was furious at his wife's escape, there was no doubt. Eleanor was pleased, rather than sorry, hopeful that the poor, frightened, exhausted woman had found sanctuary, wondering if she could find haven herself if she decided to run. The night before the dark of the moon, Eleanor was one of the handful of novices chosen to sing the Pale Mother's praises. They formed the merest sliver of white as they stood in the courtyard and lifted their faces, lifted their voices, mimicking the thin curve of a fading moon. It was cold out, and Leah was shivering, but Eleanor felt the chill night air wrap her in calm and stillness. Almost, her mind was clear. Almost, her heart was serene. The Black Mother seemed much closer than the Silver Lady. As midnight struck, and the girls turned toward the convent, Chevelle stopped Eleanor with a touch. "Stay a minute," the older woman said. And Eleanor obediently paused and waited until all the other novices were inside. "Tomorrow night, the Lestra must ride to make an appointment," Chevelle said in an unfriendly voice. "She wishes you to travel with her and guide her on the path. She says, you are Dark Moon Daughter,
and that you will not lose the way.
Ah, the hostility came because Chevelle was jealous. She hated to see anyone, even Darris, receive a mark of the Lestra's favor.
Certainly, I am available to serve the Lestra if she needs me, Eleanor said. When shall I meet her, and where?
In the courtyard, shortly after the sun goes down. It is a trip best undertaken at night.
Any trip made under cover of darkness was bound to be illicit to some degree, Eleanor thought with some disquiet. In the Lyrans, men rode to war at night, or carried out raids against a hated Sabata. Rarely did someone ride at night to bring happy news.
I'll be here. You may be excused from your afternoon duties, Chevelle said grudgingly. You will be riding long hours. Sleep in the afternoon while you can.
I will.
Accordingly, the following night, Eleanor arrived in the courtyard, rested, fed, and dressed for travel. In the last instance, that meant wearing a long, dark cloak over her white novice robes. If they were traveling at night, surely the Lestra would not particularly want them to be seen. There were already a dozen soldiers milling around just inside the gate, mounted on dark horses. A young recruit was holding the bridles of three additional animals. One was the Lestra's own stallion, a large, nervous beast, coal black and magnificent. The others were just horses from the stables, but also sporting dark coats and accoutrements that were innocent of bright ornamentation. This was a party designed to move through the night without drawing any undue attention. A minute later, the Lestra and Chevelle joined them, and the soldiers scrambled to help the three women into their saddles. No one had said anything to Eleanor, and no one said much now.
"Ride out," the lead guard called in a quiet voice, and the gates were swung open.
The party trotted out into the forest, into the night. For the first hour of the journey, Eleanor was wholly ignored, riding somewhere in the center of the group. Chevelle and the Lestra were in the lead, preceded only by two guards who seemed to be guiding them out of the forest. They took a path Eleanor did not know, for it didn't lead west toward Neft or east toward Korriban, the way she and Rosary had come. Winding their way north, they eventually broke free of the overgrown trees. They intersected some road that looked like a major thoroughfare, but only stayed on it for a mile or two, before turning off on a twisty, poorly marked path that would be hard to find if you didn't know what you were looking for. After an hour of cautious travel down this road, the whole party came to a stop. Eleanor watched a brief consultation between the Lestra and the lead soldier, and was not surprised when Chevelle suddenly turned and called her name. She nudged her horse forward to join the knot of people at the head of the group.
"Now is when we need your help, Dark Moon Daughter," the Lestra said in an encouraging voice. "The way is obscured, but the prize at the end is very great. Can you show us how to go? Can you follow the path, even though the Silver Lady shuts her eyes?"
Eleanor's heart was pounding so hard it was difficult to speak. What lay at the end of this road?
"I can," she said. "The Great Mother guides me."
The lead soldier pointed somewhere toward the northeast.
"There's a path here, but I can't find it. We need to follow that another 5 miles.
Eleanor cast her eyes in the direction he indicated. Yes, she could see what he was seeking, a rough track that looped through a rocky valley and then lost itself in a stand of starved trees.
"I see it," she said, her voice so quiet it was possible none of them heard her. "Follow me."
She turned her horse down the rocky path and slowly led them forward. It took them nearly 2 hours to make their way across the valley, into the thin woods, and along the unmarked trail toward their destination, wherever it was. Eleanor had no problem seeing the route they were supposed to take, but it was heavily overgrown, not often traveled,
and littered with hazards. Dread also weighted her limbs. She could not come up with any good reason the Lestra needed to make this pilgrimage in the middle of the night, under a blank new moon. It occurred to her, once or twice, to pull on the reins and shake her head, claim that she could not follow the track any farther, say that her vision failed. But then she would give herself a little scold. Don't be ridiculous. The Lestra is meeting some friend or counselor, someone you do not know who is much wiser than you. The Lestra lives by nighttime, as do you, as does your goddess. There is nothing to fear. Keep going forward. It was somewhere around midnight when the trail ended abruptly in front of a tiny cottage in a shallow valley stubbled with small bare bushes. The cottage was dark. No scent of burning wood escaped from the shuttered windows or thatched roof. No one home, Eleanor thought with relief. Nonetheless, she expected the Lestra to ride up to the door and pound on it, demanding admittance. She did not. Instead, she nodded at the soldiers and reined her horse aside, as if to get out of the way. Chevelle followed her. Eleanor, not knowing what else to do, pulled her mount up beside theirs. There was a flash of fire, brilliant in the utter blackness, and then a moment of waiting. Then the fire grew, passed from hand to hand, and Eleanor saw that the men of their party were ringing the cottage, and each of them held a torch. "Now!" the lead guard called, and as one, the men spurred their horses closer to the cottage and touched their brands to the outer walls. In a few places, the wood was wet or stubborn and did not catch, but within minutes small blazes had taken hold in a dozen or so spots along the bare wood. "No!" Eleanor cried, and felt her fingers tighten on her reins, as if she would ride forward and blow out the fire with her own breath. Chevelle stopped her with a hand on her arm. "No one is home," the older daughter said in a chilly voice. "Don't be alarmed."
But this is someone's house. Why should it be burned? Chevelle, why are we here?"
"Calm yourself," Chevelle said icily, glancing over at the Lestra. The other woman appeared not to be aware of their voices at all. She was gazing fixedly at the leaping flames, her expression engrossed, but wholly at peace. "It is the will of the goddess." Eleanor swallowed and tried to compose herself, but she felt her hands shaking. Why travel through the night to destroy someone's home? What was the point? Who was supposed to receive what message from such a vengeful act? And then the night was rent with an awful scream of terror, rage, and pain. Eleanor felt her whole body slivered with horror. Someone was inside. Someone was burning to death inside the cottage. She clutched Chevelle's arm so hard the older daughter hissed in pain.
"Chevelle, someone's in the house. It sounds like a woman. Look, I see a face at the window. Chevelle, they must save her. She will die."
Chevelle shook her hand free and slapped Eleanor hard across the cheek. Her low voice was cold with fury as she replied, "The house burns as it was meant to burn." Eleanor stared at her, and she thought her own body would go up in flames. Again, a shriek from the cottage, another one. The soldiers had pulled their horses back far enough to keep themselves from being singed, but they were close enough to stop anyone who tried to run from the blazing building.
"You said there was no one inside," Eleanor whispered.
Chevelle shrugged. "No one inside but mystics." There were times Eleanor truly did not think she would survive the night. Chevelle's words had almost caused her to faint out of the saddle, and black spots peppered her vision, making it impossible to see. The acrid smell of smoke, the continuing shrieks of terror, the sudden cessation of screaming as a roof beam crashed into the burning house. All this combined to make Eleanor so sick she leaned over and vomited past her shoe. Twice. A third time. Nothing more came up, but she stayed bent over the pommel for another 10 minutes, unable to move. In a way, it was worse when the screaming stopped. In a way, it was a relief. Dead now, or senseless, the woman inside the cottage, gathered up in the black mother's gentle embrace. Still, the soldiers kept their vigilant circle around the house, waiting to see if this was perhaps a trick, if the woman was even now gathering her strength for a quick dash toward freedom. It took forever for the house to burn low enough that the guards could bank the fire and be reasonably sure it wouldn't spread to the shrubbery in the field. A few of them were even digging a shallow firebreak to keep the blaze contained. No one seemed impatient to go. The men were all either working or watching. Chevelle and the Lestra gazed at the dying flames with a sort of absorbed rapture, as if they represented a mysterious beauty of rare and divine splendor. Eleanor sat the whole time, curled in the saddle, turned into a single compact lump of pain. When the Lestra finally sighed and clucked to her horse, Eleanor was not sure she'd be able to straighten up and resume riding. The fidgety stallion had tossed his head and danced around a little while they waited, but all in all, he had behaved remarkably well for such a high-spirited beast. "He must be used to nights such as this," Eleanor thought. "We should be getting back," the Lestra said, and though her voice was quiet, all the soldiers heard her. They tugged on their own reins and fell into formation behind the women, and then, for a moment, no one moved. Eleanor gradually became aware that everyone was looking in her direction. "Dark Moon, daughter?" the Lestra asked in a kind voice. "Are you up to directing us back to the main road? This has been a long night for you, I know, and you are not comfortable with the Silver Lady's swift justice. But you must harden your heart. You must remember that those who practice magic have put themselves outside the Pale Mother's grace. You must understand that mystics are abominations. They must be destroyed wherever they are found." "I understand," Eleanor whispered. "I understand far better than you know." She forced her cramped muscles to unclench, pushed herself almost upright in the saddle. "She's been sick," Chevelle said reluctantly to the Lestra.
"Yes, I know she has, but she will be stronger now," the Lestra said, her voice sounding most sympathetic.
She urged her big horse closer to Eleanor's and held out her hand. In it was a small, fluid shape that Eleanor recognized as a water bag.
"You will feel better if you have something to drink. Take a few sips, and then lead us on our way."
Eleanor would have liked to refuse, to fling the container to the ground at the stallion's sharp feet, but she was too thirsty, and there was so much distance left to cover. She murmured her thanks and lifted the bag to her mouth, greedily sucking down half the contents. How could a tainted gift from such a vile source taste so sweet?
"Thank you," she said again, handing it back. "I'm better now. I'll lead until someone else knows the way."
She made herself straighten her shoulders and guide them all back toward the road. She was in front of the party, so no one could see her lips move. No one could catch her silent, desperate prayer.
"Great Mother, ride beside me. Great Mother, pour your strength into my body. Great Mother, show me what I must do."
She felt the breeze stir about her so faintly that it was as gentle as a mother's breath on a baby's neck. The sky overhead grew even blacker as clouds scrolled over the face of the night, hiding the helpless stars. A few of the men riding to the rear murmured apprehensively among themselves, worrying about a possible storm, but Eleanor knew it was no such thing. Merely, the Dark Watcher had settled in. She felt the goddess's presence during the whole of that interminable trek. It was as if the Black Mother laid her hand on Eleanor's back and bade her lean against it for comfort. It was as if she brushed her lips across Eleanor's cold cheek and promised her the night would hold no more terrors. Once, Eleanor saw an owl fly overhead, white and silent, a midnight hunter. Three or four times, she noticed bats swooping by, dipping close enough to see her face and then clawing their way back up through the sticky air. For a good hour, she knew that a wolf paced beside them, an envoy from the goddess, protector of the Black Mother's lost children. A moth came and settled on Eleanor's hands where they were wrapped around the reins, and rested there for the whole of that endless journey. As her body loosened with exhaustion and her ears still rang with the mystic screams, Eleanor clung to the only thing that made sense in this whole dreadful night, the feeling that the Great Mother had enveloped her in healing hands and would carry her safely home, the belief that the idle wind had whispered actual words in her ear, "I am here. I am holding you. I will not let you go." For the first 2 days after she made it back to the convent, Eleanor did nothing but sleep. Darris came and checked on her 3 times. Astira and Leah were at the door every few hours offering food and anxiously asking what they could do to help. It was easier to let people believe she was physically ill, not heartsick, so Eleanor allowed them to wipe her face with cold water and feed her bowls of thin soup, and then she went back to sleep. Rosary showed only the most cursory interest in her condition, though she did keep the chamber pot emptied and the room clean and made sure the candle was lit and set in the window every night. "Let me know if you need something," her cousin said in such a perfunctory way that Eleanor was not moved to ask for help or advice. "I'm fine," she said. "I just want to sleep." But sleep brought no answers, and neither did the wakeful hours spent lying in bed, staring at the walls, trying to decide what to do. She had to leave the convent, that was certain. Where could she go? Where could she turn for aid? If she went to Neft, Justin would help her. If she went to Justin, and her brothers found out, Justin would die. If she left the convent without Rosary, her father might ban her from the house. If she left the convent and did not return to the Lyrans, Eleanor would die. She had to leave the convent and bring Rosary with her and make it safely to the Lyrans without anyone's assistance. Therefore, as she rose from her sickbed on that 3rd day, Eleanor decided that Rosary had become her priority. It was impossible to talk to her cousin for most of the day, however. The novices, who were Eleanor's particular friends, gathered around her in the dining hall at breakfast, asking how she felt, exclaiming over her paleness. "You look so thin," Leah said. "You haven't been sick long enough to lose so much weight." "I'm fine," Eleanor said. "I'm hungry now." "You're working in the gardens today with me," Astira said. "It's cool out, not too bad. I know you like it cold. It will do you good to get sun on your face." "Where's Rosary working? She was gone from the room when I got up this morning." Astira made a face. "She's off with Chevelle and Darris. Some great plan they're hatching. A new ritual or something, I don't know. We won't see her again till dinner time." Indeed, the entire day passed without a glimpse of Rosary. But it was a restful, healing sort of day, even so. As Astira had predicted, Eleanor gathered strength from working outside, pulling up the dead weeds and discarded stalks, clearing out piles of leaves from the bare garden. The brisk air calmed her circling thoughts and made her skin tingle with sensation. She wouldn't have gone inside all day, even for lunch, except that she was so hungry. Rosary was present at dinner, but sitting too far away for Eleanor to talk to her, and then Rosary was chosen to sing the evening devotional, while Eleanor was sent back to their room. Eleanor went upstairs, lit the candle, unbound her hair, and brushed it out with slow, methodical strokes. It had been weeks since Rosary had last dyed it for her. Maybe her cousin would have time tomorrow to add new pattern lines. But Eleanor never got a chance to ask. She fell asleep before Rosary returned to the room, and Rosary was still abed the next morning when Eleanor had to hurry downstairs to help with breakfast. The entire rest of the week went that way, Eleanor and Rosary speaking briefly in passing, but never having a moment when they were alone in the same room at the same time long enough to talk. When one of them was chosen to sing the nightly rituals, the other was sent up to her room. When one of them was assigned morning duty in the kitchens, the other had a chance to sleep in. Finally, at the end of that week, as the moon waxed toward full, a majority of novices had been kept behind to sing, and Rosary and Eleanor were both with the group that stood in the courtyard and lifted their voices. At midnight, they climbed the stairs and let themselves into their room and quickly began getting ready for bed.
"I wonder if we could stay up and talk a few minutes," Eleanor said, as Rosary lit the candle in the window. "I feel like I've scarcely seen you. Astira said you've been consulting with Darris and Chevelle on something."
Rosary laughed.
"I suppose you could call it that. I wanted to know what I had to do to take the next step, to move from a novice to proselyte. Darris and Chevelle are dedicants, and of course I can't be one of those, not yet, though I want to be someday. But there are only 10 proselytes, and Deanna will become a dedicant in a few months, and so there is room for me," Chevelle said. "But it's a lot of work." Every word Rosary said made Eleanor feel more depressed and anxious.
"So you think you don't ever plan? You want to stay here for the rest of your life?" she said.
"You don't ever think you'll go back to the Lyrans?"
"Never," Rosary said. Eleanor moved on the bed, sitting up with her back to the wall.
"But, Rosary, I want to go back," she said in a whisper. I am not as happy here as you are, and I don't think the family will let me return without you."
"Then stay," Rosary said.
She had been perched on the edge of her bed, but now she joined Eleanor on hers.
"You say you're not happy here, but you would be if you would just give yourself over to the goddess. If you would let her take over your heart and your mind. If you would make her will your will. It's not easy, I know. I want to push myself into her arms, fling myself at the Silver Lady, but I hesitate. I get afraid. And then I despise myself for my cowardice. I want to find a way to show her I am worthy so that she will take me as her own."
Eleanor could understand a little of that devotion, so she felt about the Black Mother, whose presence was so real in Eleanor's life. But something about Rosary's voice, her expression, made Eleanor shiver. It was as if Rosary's love for the Pale Mother bordered on madness. Obviously, Rosary would not be disposed to listen to Eleanor's tale of mystics burned at the behest of the Moon Goddess, or she might hear the story and react far differently than Eleanor had hoped. Praise be to the Silver Lady for striking down mystics, burning them where they lay.
"I don't think I have your willpower, Rosary," Eleanor said instead. "But I will hope with all my heart that you attain your own dream, that you become a proselyte and a dedicant in service to the goddess."
"I will," Rosary said confidently. "I just have to think of a way to prove my worth."
The conversation unsettled Eleanor so much that even after Rosary returned to her own bed and fell asleep, she could not close her eyes. Clearly, she would not be able to persuade Rosary to leave. Clearly, she could not stay. She should just plan her own escape then, slowly amass food that would take her through a couple weeks of travel, study a map, if she got a chance, so that she could visualize her route. If she left at night, it was possible no one would miss her for an entire day. Rosary would think she had risen early to work in the kitchens, and it was unlikely anyone else would sound the alarm, and she would be able to slip away under cover of darkness. Nothing easier. That decision made, she was able to fall asleep. But she was so tired that she had a hard time waking. What eventually made her open her eyes was a long pounding at the door and the sound of Astira's voice laughing outside. "Come on, you two, wake up. Breakfast is over and you're both supposed to be helping me in the kitchen. Were you up all night talking? I'm coming in." Eleanor yawned and struggled to gain full consciousness just as the door swung open. Astira's shriek made her snap her jaw shut and sit up, staring around. Rosary lay on her back on the cold stone floor, completely nude, her arms spread out, her hands cupped beseechingly, her eyes open but unseeing. All around her, like sloppily harvested wheat, her long hair lay in patterned drifts. Her skull was imperfectly shaven, nicked here and there from a badly wielded knife or razor. A thin line of blood traced a route from her forehead down her cheek on the right side of her face. Rosary had sacrificed her hair, her family, her sabata, to the Silver Lady, then apparently had fallen into a trance from which she would not soon be wakened. Neither Astira's second scream nor Eleanor's scramble to the floor caused Rosary to flutter or stir. Eleanor put up a shaking hand to check Rosary's pulse, but her heart was still beating. She was still alive. She had merely given herself completely over to the goddess. Chapter 25. Darris allowed Eleanor to spend the entire day in the infirmary, though there was very little either of them could do for Rosary.
"But while you're here, you may as well see if you can help Deanna. She's had a cough for 2 weeks now, and she's just miserable. And you could fold these cloths for me. That's a good girl. I don't know how everything got into such a muddle."
Eleanor did everything Darris requested, but only half-heartedly. She certainly wasn't going to risk calling on the Black Mother's power to see if she could help poor, wretched Deanna, who sounded like she might cough her life away. Not when mystics were being burned in their houses. Not when anyone who noticed what Eleanor did would think she was a mystic. She didn't even want to summon magic to see if she could call Rosary back from her ecstatic trance. This was a matter between the goddesses. If Rosary had offered herself to the Silver Lady and the Silver Lady had accepted her, Eleanor had no right to ask the Dark Watcher to pull her cousin back from the brink of oblivion. Rosary would not thank her, and the Pale Mother might not forgive her. Eleanor was already wary of incurring the Silver Lady's wrath. Now was not the time to put a foot wrong. But she was still consumed by anxiety all day as she watched Rosary lie motionless on her sickbed. It could not be good to lie so still, to loiter so close to death. Rosary took no food or water all day, did not speak, did not even appear to be breathing. Eleanor could not think what she would tell the Sabata if Rosary died. A hasty dinner with the other girls, whispering to Astira and Leah what little she knew, then Eleanor was back in the sick room to spend the night. Deanna was still coughing, and a novice had been brought in with a similar ailment, so Eleanor would have plenty to occupy her during the hours she could not sleep.
"Hope there isn't a sickness that sweeps through the whole convent, but there probably is," Darris grumbled. "I heard Chevelle coughing over dinner. Next thing you know, it'll be you and me."
Eleanor found she did not much care if Chevelle came down with a dreadful illness that kept her confined to the infirmary for weeks. She wouldn't lift a hand to aid the dedicant, wouldn't even whisper a prayer to the Silver Lady. Let someone else care if Chevelle was sick or well. Let someone else nurse her. Eleanor would not be able to show the older daughter any kindness at all. She did, however, try to ease Deanna and the other patient through the night, though she was still afraid to try any magic. Magic. How quickly she had come to accept that word to describe what she was capable of when the Black Mother moved through her body. How quickly she had come to believe that she